This podcast is brought to you by AJ Bell and Shares Magazine. Shares Magazine is published by AJ Bell Media, part of AJ Bell.
Hi, welcome back to Money and Markets, where we take a run through of all the big financial and investing news of the past week. I'm Dan from Shares, and with me is Laura from AJ Bell.
Hey, so today we're going to be looking at how you can find investments yielding more than 5%, why it might be okay to hand your child a large pot of money, and we'll be looking at company valuations. Joining us on the podcast this week is Steve Fraser from Shares.
Hello.
So let's start with markets this week. We've had a trade war truce of sorts. So is this going to be the start of the Santa rally, Dan?
It's a big unknown. Well, you've heard of Piano Man, haven't you? You heard of Piano Man, Billy Joel?
Yes.
You heard of Spider-Man?
Yes.
You ever heard of Tariff Man?
Sounds much less exciting.
I know. Donald Trump seems to have taken on an alter ego, just as everyone thought that there was going to be a truce on this trade war between China and the US. He goes and tweets and reminds people that he is Tariff Man, and you can't sort of take things for certain that everything's going to be fine and you won't get these sort of more onerous tariffs that he's been threatening. And of course, that is immediately troubled the market and sent shares plunging back down again, because a few days earlier we had the Federal Reserve's kind of hinting that its interest rates in the US might not go up as fast as people thought, and then we did have that sort of agreement with that there'd be a 90-day postponement for some increase in tariffs between the US and China. So everyone was kind of sort of was expecting at the start of December, yeah, we would have this Santa rally, but certainly as we talk now, it's not looking that way. I mean, on the broader market, it's been a pretty tough time. Good week for Stagecoach, which is the bus and train operator. Its earnings were slightly better than expected, and it sort of hinted it might sell its US business. It was a bad week for Kia, which had a rights issue. Takeover was pulled for shopping centre investor Into, and shares in Thomas Cook were plunging fast following a profit warning because everyone's worried about its funding now. I mean, I know, Steve, you sort of look at the markets as much as I am.
Glaxo really stood out to me as well. I mean, clearly loads of doubt about the price they're paying for this Tesoro business. And it's all to do with immuno-oncology, so it's cancer treatment. But it's an area of the market that's not had lots of success. Paying, I think, $5 billion for it. I mean, the market's saying, hang on, that's quite a lot. It sent the shares down 7.5% on the day. I mean, it's almost unheard of to see Glaxo shares falling 7.5% in a day. So that tells you how the market feels about that deal.
So, Dan, you've also been rummaging through the data to find the investments that are going to hand you a healthy income. So bull markets have obviously driven prices up and investors have been hunting for yield, which has made it ever harder to find. But you've unearthed some investments that are still pretty decent payers.
That's right. I've been sort of taking a broader look at this subject of yield because the starting point, I guess, for everyone is to look at what you'd get for cash if you went down your building society or bank. The best rate is about 1.5% if you want to have instant access to your money. If you're prepared to store it away for a little bit longer, you can get sort of up to 2.4% on a sort of 3-year fixed rate. That's the same rate as inflation at the moment. So it's kind of still not very exciting. Hence why people are sort of still turning to the stock market to get a greater return on their money. If you bought a FTSE 100 tracker fund, you'd potentially get about 4.5% yield. But I still think a decade ago, I was having a cash ISA account with 5 or 6%. It was so easy to get something that paid kind of a decent rate. And I don't know, in my mind, that's just the figure I keep looking back for, thinking, how can I get 5%? So I had a good look at the investment trust and fund world, and I found about over 200 products that are offering that yield. Now, that is based on the payment for the last year, so and we don't really get forecasts for funds in terms of what they could pay out. But if you take the assumption that potentially, if they're operating the same way and the fund manager's following the same process, you could potentially get 5%. So far, so good. But
and 200 funds sounds like quite a lot to me. That's more than I would have thought.
It's definitely, it was good. Immediately, so I saw the list. I thought, this is good, a good starting point. But then I thought, hang on a minute, there's some weird and wonderful stuff on this list. I thought, what, you know, it's never as simple as you want it to be when you're just looking for an investment to give you a specific rate of return. So within this, you can sort of categorize them as income boosters, which are funds that fiddle around selling options. And I think the average public will find them quite hard to understand. Now, there's funds that invest in emerging market debt. Again, that's probably off the radar of a lot of people, unless you're sort of happy to take on sort of these higher risks. There's high yield bonds, which is when they invest in companies that have a lower credit rating than you might find with sort of higher quality corporate and government bonds. But you're getting that high yield in exchange for investing in higher risk assets. And the final sort of area was investing in high yielding individual company shares. But again, you have to remember that the high yield, say above 6 or 7%, is potentially a result of a falling share price. So if the market's thinking, I'm not quite convinced about the earnings forecast, the share price will fall. But if the dividend forecast hasn't changed, suddenly the yield looks much, much higher. Sorry, it's a bit complicated talking about this on a podcast without sort of, I guess if you look at your figures on a spreadsheet on a bit of paper, you might understand this a bit better. But
In stocks, I mean, Vodafone's been a classic example, hasn't it? Because I mean, the market's been debating whether it can afford its dividend for ages, and its yield has gone up to about 8% at some points. It's still now about 6.5%, and no one's really sure about, well, is this sustainable? So if it's 6.5%, then that's a brilliant value stock to own for the long term, but is it sustainable? And that's always the big question. So when you start really getting quite fat, you have to start questioning whether it's sustainable. That's a key thing.
I mean, so some of the other, looking at the individual companies at the moment, you've got Persimmon, which is a house builder. That's yielding 12% based on what analysts are forecasting for next year's dividend payment. Direct Line, the insurance company, is yielding just over 8%. Imperial Brands, the tobacco companies, almost at 9%. Evraz, the mining sort of steel company, is close to 14%. I mean, on paper, these look pretty interesting, but they've all got sort of a caveat, all sorts of risk. Mining companies shouldn't really be paying out yields. They'll get back to the usual routine of shoving all their money to make acquisitions again. They're only paying yields at the moment because they've been kind of told off by investors when commodity prices fell about 5 years ago for spending too much money. And they were paying yields to wait for the uptick in commodity prices. With house builders, you know, who knows what's going to happen with property prices? So there's sort of big question marks about what the future earnings of these companies could be. And the sector fears with tobacco, tougher regulation. So really the message is, yes, there are some really big yield opportunities out there, but you're going to have to take high risk. And I think that perhaps people underestimate what to look for when they're making those investments.
I also think that one thing that's worth pointing out, that when we talk to equity income managers, so the professionals that are doing this, is balancing that high yield today with the yield payers of tomorrow. So having a balance in your portfolio of those that are going to give you a decent payout today, but also those that are able to grow their yield over years. So you're not just saying, well, this is a big fat juicy payout this year, but it might be nothing next year. It's actually looking at the ones that can keep pace with inflation and increase their payouts each year, isn't it?
Definitely. I think dividend growth is extremely important, and you want that annual growth to be greater than the rate of inflation. So the real value of your money is not being gobbled away by Mr. Nasty Inflation. So, it comes back to when you do investing, you've got to do a lot of homework. It's not simply thinking, oh, well, look, there's a house builder. Look, we all know the UK is short of homes, therefore house builders must be good investments, or like something like Direct Line or insurance companies, because we all need them. We have to pay these things, therefore they're still going to be around. You can't make those assumptions. You've got to look under the bonnet, or you turn to the services of a fund manager who kind of does that work for you, hopefully. Okay, but in terms of speaking of investing wisely, Laura, I know you've been looking at junior ISAs. We're getting to the point now where we're getting data that's showing the children who have held their accounts, whether the parents or grandparents have been investing on their behalf, they're now turning 18 and they will become the legal owners of this money. what's been happening? Are they all cashing out and spending it on a trip to Ibiza? Or are they being quite sensible just keeping invested at the start of their own personal investment journey? What's your data found?
Yeah, so I had a look, and obviously the big concern for many parents putting money into a junior ISA is that it does become the child's when they reach age 18. So they worry that they are just going to go and splurge it on down the pub or going on a holiday. But actually, that doesn't seem to be the case. So I looked at AJ Bell customer data, and of those that turned 18 this year, only 7% cashed out of their junior ISA, which is actually a lot lower than I imagined.
That's really lower than
obviously AJ Bell users are much more sensible than I took them for.
I wonder if, do you think it's down to parents who are sort of keeping quiet and not sort of reminding their children that they're sitting on this money, or whether they're sort of saying, well, you know, there are some conditions, I have been saving for you, but you know, if you're going to go to university, this money is going to help pay for it.
Yeah, it's probably a bit of both. It's probably also, there's an element, I think, and I would stress strongly that I have no kind of data or anything to back this up, but I would imagine the parents that are investing their money in a junior ISA account and putting money away for their kids are probably doing quite well at home, instilling good financial literacy and responsible kind of finances in their children. So I'd imagine there might be an element of the kind of financially literate parents rubbing off on their kids, and their kids then realizing that if they want to be able to go to university or buy a car or whatever, have money, have a house deposit for the future, they need to keep hold of that money, because it is, could be quite a decent pot by this size. So obviously before junior ISAs there were child trust funds, and you could transfer your child trust fund into a junior ISA, and you still can, but if you'd save the maximum each year for these kids that are turning 18, they'd have more than £31,000 in their junior ISA account. So it's a decent amount.
Yeah, that's surprising, that.
Yeah, it's very, very good. And I guess the other key question is, what is in these junior ISAs? Is it parents taking masses of risk and buying kind of boom or bust style?
Must be a big cash element, I would have thought.
Yeah. Or are they being conservative about it?
There's a real, real mixture, as you would imagine, I guess. But predominantly, there are a lot of the kind of big name fund managers. So you've got Nick Train in there, Neil Woodford, you've got Terry Smith. So a lot of those really popular, well-proven, long-running managers. Because I guess some parents will put this money in here and then top it up each year, but just add to those existing funds and want a fund that they can rely on for 10 years. There is quite a lot of cash in them. There's about 15% of the accounts are in cash. And so that is quite a high amount, but we did look at customers who'd reached age 18. So it might be that some parents have cashed out some of it in anticipation of the kids withdrawing the money to use for a house deposit or for...
So it's a bit like as if you're having coming up to retirement, you switch your investment portfolio to have low risk in those final years of your working. So, because you don't really want... Well, some people may not want to start retirement being invested in higher risk stuff. Do you think there's an element of that with the parents sort of saying, well, I know that at 18 that they may want to use this money for university. So say at 15 onwards, 15 to 18, they're switching from the high risk octane stuff to lower risk, or is it too hard to draw that conclusion?
It's quite hard to draw that conclusion. I would imagine some of it is that, or parents that have earmarked that money. I mean, age 18, you could be going to university and parents may have earmarked this money because it is a tax efficient way to save. And so they might be passing it to their kids to say, well, this is going to pay for your rent for first year of uni or whatever. I also think that there is a certain amount of apathy probably from some parents. I mean, the stats overall on junior ISAs are that a lot of people just leave them in cash. And if you're starting when the child is born, you've got an 18-year period where it's tied up, which makes it the ideal investment rather than holding it in cash. But we consistently see that very high levels of junior ISA money just sits in cash. And I think there's an element where obviously parents are very time pressured and they think, right, I've opened this account, I've put the money in, and then they just kind of maybe forget about it.
Well, I guess, you know, even in cash is still good, isn't it? You know, it's fair enough, you could say there's inflation's eating into it, but I guess cash versus nothing is...
Cash versus
you're only
nothing.
Getting a tax benefit, aren't you? Because, I mean, it being a tax wrapper. But if you've got fundamentally 0.1% interest rates, I mean, it's not going to do very much for you, is it?
No, exactly. Investing, particularly over that really long period, you're going to definitely benefit from. But yeah, we did see some real kind of juxtaposition of what parents are doing. Some have taken that approach of, it's going to be locked up for 18 years, so I'm going to go for some pretty high risk pretty high octane stuff. Some took the approach of, this is my money for my children's future and I don't want to risk it all on one slightly harebrained stock. And so they went for much more reliable managers. So there was quite a split there.
So Steve, you've been looking into a growing debate on whether company accounting practices are out of date for certain sectors. Can you explain what's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, this is not new news as such, but I suppose with the emergence of sort of the FANG stocks in particular and high octane growth companies, we're becoming a bit unsettled about how to value these businesses. And it's, when you use old-fashioned terms like price to earnings ratios, lots of these companies can look really, really super expensive. But of course, the answer, the alternative view is that these companies are going to be growing for years, not just 1 or 2 years down the line, but for 5, 10, 15 years, or who knows how long. So it's what is a better metric? And it's also moving into the digital world. So I mean, increasingly, these businesses are emerging that are asset light. So what we mean by that is that they don't have lots of property, they don't have lots of manufacturing equipment. And these are the kind of assets that used to underpin old economy businesses. But I mean, if you're an online retailer, I mean, you know, you don't need huge amounts of shops, and you're not paying loads and loads of staff necessarily. So it's about changing the way we value businesses, and you know, don't throw all the old economy metrics out the window, but blend them perhaps with metrics that better suit businesses that are very, very digital, very virtual. So experts I've spoken to and comment I've read, it seems to be a move shift away from price to earnings, price to net assets, that kind of valuation metric, and increasingly look at cash flow. Cash flow is one of the hardest things to mess around with. We hear lots about shenanigans on balance sheets and profit and loss accounts, but the cash flow statement is really quite hard to manipulate. So balancing good, strong free cash flow and using that as an investment metric may be one solution to balancing these older economy, newer economy businesses, so you can get a better spread of, well, what is my risk in terms of what is the potential going forward. So I think it's an interesting debate, and it's going to go on and on. But it's something I'll be looking into in more depth next year, I think.
So this is the new style companies that you're looking at, intangible assets. So this is the value of the brand, isn't it, and sort of trademarks that they.
Brands, trademarks, could be intellectual property that they've developed. It could be just the networks they've built. I mean, we hear about this network effect. Something like Just Eat is a good example, where the more people use a platform, the more attractive it becomes for other people and restaurants to sign up to the platform. So it becomes this kind of virtuous circle. And lots of businesses are trying to develop these valuable network effects, but they're quite hard to value and stick a value on. And it needs a bit more creative thinking, I think, to come up with reasonable value. Valuations, because they are valuable items in themselves, but you know, you can't physically hold them like you can a bit of machinery or a building. So it's working our way around coming up with sensible valuation metrics for companies that are growing in different ways, but maybe growing very quickly.
But I presume if all things went bad at the end of the day, investors would still go back to sort of the old style of, you know, do you have a property that you can sell to help sort of settle up any financial obligations, or so it's not like physical assets are completely
that's why I say I mean, this is not a case of chucking baby out with the bathwater. I think it's just blending old ways of valuing stocks with newer interpretations to reflect businesses that are completely unique. I mean, 50 years ago, an Amazon could not have existed. The internet has made the ability to reach out. Distribution costs have been absolutely slashed because you can reach out to all over the world now very, very cheaply. So, you know, Amazon's one of the most successful businesses there is. And what does it really own? You know, a few warehouses, effectively. So its physical assets would be quite light, but its power is immense.
But I guess it also is a big factor in how you value that, how saleable it is and how much someone will want to buy that. So they may have built up a great... So you Just Eat, for example, built up at that great system, but... How easy is it going to be to sell it, and who would want to buy it?
Yeah, who would want to buy it? Who would want to own that kind of network? Would be open to interpretation, obviously. But I mean, that there is clear value in that network, so it would have a value on it. It doesn't necessarily have to be lots of shops. And we see in the retail environment, for example, having lots of physical stores doesn't necessarily solve your problems.
Just one more thing before we wrap up today. Laura, I saw you had a bit of the green eyes of jealousy the other day in the office.
Always.
And you seem to be immediately started to create your own channel on YouTube. Are you becoming a vlogger?
I know. I wish, considering the money involved. So when you were 7, how much did you earn?
I think I earned about 11 pence, and that was for sweeping up the ashes from... from our coal-fired power station. No.
And what about you, Steve?
This goes back to the previous conversation we've had about car washing businesses and so on. Yeah, so I don't know, maybe you'd earn 3 or 4 quid a week if you're very industrious at the weekend.
Yeah, so how about the 7-year-old boy who last year earned £17 million?
Yeah. That is amazing. Is this true?
Yeah, so it's YouTube released it. He's a boy. I mean, this whole story makes me feel so old because he makes his money by unwrapping toys and playing with them on YouTube. That's it.
Yeah, it's.
I mean, I could do that. Well, I don't think anyone will watch.
Well, that's what I sort of figured. That's what you're going to do. Are you going to be? What do you think you could do? Could you unwrap investment funds and and review them on YouTube?
Oh, that
YouTube?
Would get such a following, wouldn't yeah. it?
It might be a niche market, that one.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think I'm going to be a millionaire on it. But it really makes you kind of evaluate your life choices, doesn't it?
But this is this little kid's getting the money from his advertising, isn't it? Before he's got the network effect. He's got the masses of viewers. People want to advertise, don't they?
Because
the
so it's actually viewers, sponsored it? Posts rather yeah. than advertising, oh, which I know okay. is a bit of a kind of nuance. But yeah, so of the $22 million he made, only $1 million was from advertising.
Oh,
the rest is from sponsored yeah. posts. But apparently, if he features toys, they'll often just sell out immediately. So the new superstars of the world are 7-year-old kids.
Wow, that's...
I mean, that opens the questions about... advertising regulation, doesn't it, though? Because, I mean, increasingly we're getting a bit worried about kids being advertised at. Now, that's clearly the kind of market you want to advertise toys at kids.
Yeah.
But it'd be interesting to see how that market might develop, because you don't really want to be targeting 9-year-olds with certain products.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I just hope he's got a junior ISA.
I was going to say, I don't think his parents need to worry about that, surely, yeah. But anyway, thanks a lot for listening this week. If you've got any suggestions for future topics you want us to cover, or if you've got any feedback or comments, then please email us at podcast@ajbell.co.uk. Thanks very much.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Before you go, please remember this podcast is for educational purposes and isn't telling you whether certain investments are suitable or not. If you want help, go see a qualified financial advisor. The podcast talks about various money issues. Just don't forget that the value of investments can change and you can lose money as well as make it. You should also recognise that how an investment performed in the past may not be the same as how it behaves in the future, and that tax rules apply.